The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's great to be with you here again on a beautiful morning here in central Oklahoma, right into the thick of the summertime activities. We've got a summer educational program coming up. We've changed the name of our youth camp. That's coming up in 3 weeks, I guess. And then we've also got Celtic Throne, the performance, less than 2 weeks away. From that, so lots of summertime activities, especially for our young people. Some feedback from you listeners, just a few comments here. I grew up in the late 60s and 70s and grew up in the Worldwide Church of God, it says, remembering hearing about these prophecies of the latter days. It says, after the church fell apart, I went back into the world for a while, and I've been looking for the truth. I have found it, it says. Another one here says that their family's from Manchester, England, and that they're supportive or enthusiastic listeners to this program. So that's not far from Edstone, just up the M6, I guess it is. And then one last one, it says, once again, great program and insight. Being a servant of law enforcement myself, it's truly troubling seeing the difficulty Americans and British policing is currently facing. It says, over the years, I have been occasionally reading literature from your organization, and I'm actually seeing Bible prophecy come alive. Can you please counsel me on how I can support this organization more? Well, there's certainly many, many ways that you can do that. The more that you read our literature, and of course, we have offices all over the world that you can contact. We have ministers all over the world as well. But there's always more that each of us can do. Well, yesterday, President Trump, he spoke out against, we've had a few listeners, by the way, comment on this. There have been reports, I think a week or two ago, of 9,000 troops, I think, being removed from Germany. I guess it's more clear now that the German troop reduction, or the U.S. troops in Germany, it's going to be reduced from 52,000 down to 25,000. And yesterday, President Trump talked about why the United States is taking this step. He basically said that Germany has been delinquent, that Germany hasn't been paying its fair share. He said that Germany owes NATO billions of dollars. And really what that means is that they just haven't been spending any money on their defense. They've been letting the United States take care of most of that. He says it's a tremendous cost to the U.S. This is the president yesterday. So we're removing a number down to 25,000. It's too much money. He went on and talked about how that these troops, the German communities around the bases, love having those American troops there because it really helps to stimulate their local economy. And the president basically said, you know, it's enough. It's enough. We don't need that many troops there. And Germany needs to contribute more anyway. I just want to take you back to what Herbert Armstrong said. This is from 1952. You know, the listener there talks about how that all of these prophecies that he remembered from the 1960s and 70s, they're coming to pass. Well, here's one. This is even earlier, 1952. Mr. Armstrong says, yet in spending unprecedented billions of your dollars and mine, tax dollars, preparing Germany and Europe for defense against the war that isn't going to come. That's, of course, at the time, it was the Cold War, the USSR, the United States. And then the United States basically putting all of those troops, hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, to protect the free states in Europe, to protect the democracies in Europe. So it was basically the U.S. defending Western Europe at that time. It says preparing Germany and Europe for defense against a war that isn't going to come. It says stupid, bungling America is spending its wealth and resources to produce the Frankenstein that is going to turn on us in an offensive war of invasion and destroy our United States. So we haven't yet seen it completely fulfilled, but basically he was saying that there's not going to be a war between Western Europe and the USSR. And here's the United States spending all of these billions and billions of dollars to try to protect or to build up Europe in anticipation of a war that might happen between Germany and Russia. Never did happen. Mr. Armstrong said it wouldn't. Yet it's going to be a Frankenstein monster that turns on us. So how significant is it then? And of course, this has been in the works really since President Trump came into office in 2016. He was on the campaign trail even before becoming president, speaking about how unfair it was for the U.S. to cover. And of course, he's right. He's right about this. And there's a lot of Americans, I'm sure, that are nodding in agreement. Hearing him say what he said yesterday. Here's just a snippet of it, clip one.
So we have 52,000 soldiers in Germany. That's a tremendous amount of soldiers. It's a tremendous cost to the United States. And Germany, as you know, is very delinquent in their payments to NATO. And they're paying 1%, and they're supposed to be at 2%, and the 2% is very low. It should be much more than that. So they're delinquent of billions of dollars, and this is for years delinquent. So we're removing a number down to, we're putting the number down to 25,000 soldiers. We'll see what happens. But Germany has not been making payments.
That's the president yesterday. 52,000 down to 25,000. Now, again, just whether or not a person as an American agrees with this or not, how does it fit within the prophetic framework? Step back and just look at the bigger picture here. The Frankenstein monster, all of these years, Germany's been able to build up its economy as the U.S., the United States, has basically been its defenses, U.S. forces. Mr. Armstrong wrote in 1985, this was just before he died, he talked about the 300,000 troops stationed in Europe. This was, of course, beyond Germany's borders. But at the time of Mr. Armstrong's death, this was near the end of the Cold War. America had 300,000 troops in all of Europe, and today it's something like 62,000. And in Germany, it's about to go down to 25,000. And so there's no threats, I guess. And how's Europe, by the way? How's Europe going to react to this? How's Germany going to react? Because there is a concern there between Germany and Russia, even though they've got the Nord Stream pipeline deal and all of that. These are nations that have fought historically against one another. But Mr. Armstrong was spot on, wasn't he, back in the 1950s? Look, there's not going to be a war between Germany and Russia. What's coming, what's prophesied, is actually between Germany and the United States, or the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire and the United States. Here's one more clip from what the president said yesterday, clip two.
So we're protecting Germany and they're delinquent. That doesn't make sense. So I said we're going to bring down the soldier count to 25,000 soldiers. It varies. It's around 52,000 now, but it varies. But it's a lot. And as you know, those are well-paid soldiers. They live in Germany. They spend vast amounts of money in Germany. Everywhere around those bases is very prosperous for Germany. So Germany takes, and then on top of it, they treat us very badly on trade.
It's the president being pretty blunt yesterday on the troop drawdown in Germany. He talked about how the U.S. gets hurt on trade. It gets hurt in NATO. He's upset about the Nord Stream pipeline. The fact that Germany and Russia have this massive trade deal there. And the president, he's right. He's there saying, and as I said earlier, there's a lot of Americans who agree with him. It's enough. It's enough. We've been paying for this long enough. And we're not getting fair trade deals and so on. It's a message that resonates with quite a few people. Speaking of quite a few people, I mentioned the upcoming campaign or rally in Tulsa, just 90 minutes or so from our headquarters campus. And nearly a million people have signed up for this or have registered for this rally. And they're having it in a stadium that only has enough seats for about 20,000 people. I couldn't resist snagging this clip this morning, since it's the president talking about Oklahoma and the rally. And here he is yesterday. I think he's in the same setting as the clips that you just saw. And a reporter asks him about the rally coming up in Oklahoma and the COVID-19 concerns. And the president explaining how that the numbers of coronavirus cases in the state of Oklahoma have been quite low. And so here is the president commenting on that and also the Tulsa rally, clip 13.
Well, Oklahoma's done very well. I just spoke to the governor. He's very excited about it. Governor Stitt, who's done a terrific job. Mike, I think you can maybe speak to this. He's done a great job. Oklahoma's at a very low number. They've done really fantastic work. They have a pretty new, magnificent arena. As you probably have heard, and we're getting exact numbers out, but we're either close to or over 1 million people wanting to go. We have a 22,000-seat arena, but I think we're going to also take the convention hall next door, and that's going to hold 40,000. So we'll have 22,000 plus 40,000, which would mean that we'd have over 900,000 people that won't be able to go, but hopefully they'll be watching. But it's an amazing. Nobody's ever heard of numbers like this. I think we're going to have a great time.
Nobody's ever heard of numbers like this. I guess the closest it would be the Obama campaign in 2008. I remember, I don't think I mentioned this yesterday, but I actually went to one of Barack Obama's rallies in, I think it was in Illinois at the time. And because I wanted to just see or experience the energy, and there was quite a lot of it there, but there was nothing like the numbers he's talking about for Tulsa. And of course, Barack Obama in Illinois, that's his home turf. That's the Chicago area. That's where he's from. That's a dark blue state. These are incredible numbers. Nobody's ever heard of numbers like this. Remember this. Remember the scene, what we'll probably see on Saturday night. Here he's got an arena of 20-some thousand, and then the convention center next door at 40,000. Just remember this. Remember these numbers the next time you check out the Drudge Report, and there's all these links about how his poll numbers are plummeting, how Biden's leading with women, Biden's leading with this, minorities or whatever. The president keeps tweeting out the silent majority. How many Americans? We don't know for sure. How many Americans are looking at what's happening in our cities? Or how many of them are looking at what's happening with that new state, Chaz, in Seattle? There's quite a few that are very concerned and that are quite upset. Ben Rhodes, President Obama's top aide from the Obama administration, he wrote an article at The Atlantic this week, American Orbanism, basically saying that if President Trump is reelected, that the United States is going to go the way of Hungary. There's going to be this strong man at the helm. It's basically a dictatorship. That's what it's going to turn into. And isn't that what they said in 2016? So here they're pulling out the same old playbook. If he gets in, if he's elected, it's going to be a full-on dictatorship. If he's voted out, he's not going to leave the office. He's not going to leave the White House. He'll contest the election. All the things that they're accusing President Trump and the Republicans of doing, it's what they're doing. This is from people who still haven't accepted the results of 2016. And they're there saying that President Trump's not going to accept the results of 2020. It's almost like it's a replay of 2016. Richard was saying in his news stack today that it just feels like the Obama people are getting ready for, or rather bracing themselves for, the revelations to come from William Barr and the John Durham report. There's been quite a lot on that in the last several weeks, and we just haven't taken the time to really get into it much on this program because of all the other craziness that's going on. But last week, we've had this clip on the docket for several programs now, but last week the Attorney General was asked about, well, just how long it takes for justice to be done with respect to all of the corruption in the DOJ and the FBI during that transition period between Obama and Trump. And this was the Attorney General's comment about how the wheels of justice move, clip 9.
But I have to say that I do find a little irritating, you know, the propensity in the American public on all sides of the political spectrum, when they see something they think could be a criminal violation, saying, why hasn't this person been indicted yet? Why hasn't this person died? Why? And, you know, there's the old saying that the wheels of justice grind slow, and they do grind slow because we have due process and we follow the process. But people should not draw from the fact that no action has been taken yet, that means that people are going to get away with wrongdoing.
They shouldn't take the fact that this is going on for a time as an indication that people are going to get away with it. Those are some strong, those are some warning shots. It's coming. I mentioned the other day just how much has happened in the first, we're not even through 6 months yet. And this is the year of the election, the campaign in the United States. And think of the chaos that might happen after the November election. If Donald Trump is reelected, here's Ben Rhodes, Barack Obama's top aide, saying that he's basically in this Atlantic article, he's saying that what President Trump is trying to do is fundamentally transform the United States. And of course, that's what Obama was doing. Ben Rhodes says our democracy's insurance policy is supposed to be the resilience of our democratic institutions. And there is ample daily evidence that they are now being molded into something different before our eyes, transformed from obstacles that could contain Trump's impulses into vehicles to punish his opponents. He's using the government to punish his opponents. They're preparing for the Durham report. They're bracing themselves. And this is going to be their refrain over and again. He can't use Durham. He can't use the Attorney General to go after his political enemies, which is exactly what the Obama administration was doing in 2015 and 16. And the tables have turned, of course. The investigators are now being investigated. And just because the wheels of justice move slow, don't let that make you think that people are going to get away with wrongdoing. Americans are concerned, so many of them, about a lot of things. Our cities have gone up in flames. You've got these thugs that have taken over downtown Seattle. And it's hardly covered. It's hardly covered in the media. I saw a headline the other day. What if during the Obama years, there was a far right group, or perhaps a white supremacist group? I mentioned this with respect to the Michigan rallies. What if those far-right groups took over part of Lansing, Michigan? That would be covered every day on the news. As it is, the major media, they seem almost disinterested. Here is this radical left, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and one reporter he's actually done quite a lot of work to expose what's happened in Portland and Seattle, some of those cities in the Northwest, that just get trashed every time there's a protest. It is not a protest. It's a riot. But this journalist, Andy Ngo, he was commenting, I think he was on Sky News in Australia, and he basically said that as to whether or not it's safe, if it's safe or if it's dangerous in Chaz. And he said, well, if it's safe if you're in agreement with them ideologically. If you go into Chaz, however, and disagree with the radical left, they'll assault you. They'll rob you. They'll kick you out. You have to conform. This is the way the Marxist left thinks. You have to conform. This is a scene yesterday in Chaz. This man and woman came in there. One of them, the woman, was holding up a U.S. flag. And just look at what happens. This is clip three.
I love America, but does Black Lives Matter?
Absolutely.
Then don't fly the flag.
No, that's
fine. No, that's
fine.
Just take that shit.
That's my flag. That's okay. My property.
But that's on human.
No. That's, okay. Not, that's also. That's not right. No. Okay.
One of the Chaz residents asked her, do Black Lives Matter? She says, of course. And then his response, if you didn't hear it, then don't fly that flag. Get rid of that flag. This is in Seattle. This is downtown Seattle. Get rid of the United States flag. Those athletes that would take a knee, they tell you it's not about the flag. It's not about the flag. It's about justice. It is about the flag. It is about America. They are disrespecting America and its founding institutions. They are disrespecting the flag and the national anthem and the U.S. military. There's been a massive demand for private security in Seattle. This is a left-wing city. This has been ruled by left-wing politicians, radical left politicians, for decades. And you've got residents in these dark blue cities that are afraid because law enforcement has evacuated. They've just handed over six city blocks to these thugs. And they're handing out guns. In some cases, they're handing out guns to young people. Mob rule. And so the ordinary citizen of Seattle, terrified. What is happening to our city? And here come all these reports saying just how President Trump is getting poor poll numbers or whatever. Well, it's not a political thing, right or left. The problems run deeper than one political party over another. God says it's our sins. It's the sickness. The faint-heartedness, as I covered on yesterday's program. There was a recent poll asking whether or not Americans are very proud or extremely proud to be American. And that, speaking of polls, that's hit its lowest level since Gallup started conducting the poll back in 2001. So the lowest level in 20 years. The Federalist says Monday's figures show a sharp 7-point decline since last year, where only 70% said they were either very proud or extremely proud of their American heritage, the largest single-year decrease recorded, the largest ever. And when you see what the radical left has done in the university, in popular culture, when you see the message that they're taking with them to the streets, these are a lot of young people, white and black, someone said about the Chaz residents. Fatherless young people. Fatherless young people just taking over a city. Saying that, well, this is for black lives. This is for justice. The Frontier Center. This is from, I think, National Review. And it's an article based on this study. This study from the Frontier Center. It says, if Black Lives Matter succeeds, it will have re-engineered the minds of America to view our system, our history, and our future through the lens of division and hate. It says, in its dishonest weakening of public trust in the police officer, the representative of law and order and equality before the law, Black Lives Matter weakens the very foundations of our country. And you see, a lot of Americans see this. You can't say anything about it. You can't speak out about it. If you do, you probably get fired. Silent majority. This is weakening the United States. It's not strengthening it. I spoke with one of our listeners recently. I don't think I mentioned this to you, but one of our listeners who just at his place of employment, he talks back and forth with someone who's fairly well educated and who keeps up with the news. He leans maybe a little bit to the left. But this coworker basically said to one of our listeners that there's no fixing this. There's no turning back. How do you put this back together? We're so divided. The country's so broken. So what must that listener think? Or he's not a listener, but he's a coworker of one of our listeners. But what must he think about the future for his children? A lot of people are very concerned. You saw it even from those two comments I read at the start of the show. Long-time listeners of Herbert Armstrong, and then maybe they drifted away from the truth, and now they're searching again because they see what's happening in the world, and they remember. They remember what Herbert Armstrong said about Germany, about NATO, about race riots. This article, the National Review, it says, cop hate is critical and central to Black Lives Matter's strategy. Think of this. Cop hate is critical to their strategy. And this is an organization, as I've been noting in the last week, it just receives almost universal praise right across the board. Right, left, center. You cannot criticize. You cannot criticize this organization. And here, one of the central tenets of its doctrine, its strategy, it's police hate, cop hate. It says, because by vilifying the police, by portraying individual officers and departments in general as racist, despite clear evidence refuting systemic charges, it will achieve the objective of harming the principle of the rule of law. That is vital. And when that happens, the left will strike and strike hard, and in many places, strike with impunity. That's what we've been seeing. They have been striking and striking with impunity. They're just getting away with lawlessness. And the president comes along and says, look, we've got to uphold the rule of law. And if you don't get control of Seattle, I will. Well, let's see what he ends up doing. Right now, it's a lot of rhetoric. But Ben Rhodes hears it and thinks, this is going to be a dictatorship. Someone that comes in and says, let's uphold the law. The radical left sees that as a threat. They want mob rule. They want confusion. They want chaos. They want to bring down the system. They want to do anything in their power to return to power. It says here, this is actually from a separate article, that 55% of Democrats support defunding the police. So that's now mainstream. That's Black Lives Matter. The other side of that, of course, is if you're a Democrat, you'd begin to get a little bit worried if even 45% of your party is not supportive of this. It'll be interesting. Speaking of silent majorities, it'll be interesting to see when the final count is in November, how many minorities and how many moderates or even Democrats vote for President Trump. But coming back to the division and how you're even going to be able to put this back together, this was from Greg Gutfeld yesterday. He's a Fox News commentator just talking about how that this division, this divisiveness, It's leading to a race war. Clip four.
We are offering almost no context anymore to these events when these videos come out. And I think we're leaving our country at the mercy of a dangerous narrative fueled by these horrific videos that can ultimately destroy a country. When you're having 10 million arrests and something like 50 million police encounters a year, you know, 10 of these incidents could very easily happen. Maybe 20, twice a month. Maybe you could have two of them a month. If we treat these the way we treat them now without context, this country is not going to survive. We have to stop making this a black versus white issue and make it a black and white issue. Because right now, the narrative that we're operating under is heading towards a race war.
That's Fox News commentator yesterday. That's mainstream cable. This is not thetrumpet.com. If we continue down this road, if we stay with this narrative, if we disregard the facts, in other words, if we just keep whipping people into a frenzy of hatred and rage, we're heading towards a race war. This is why some former members of the Worldwide Church of God are now looking for the truth. Maybe they've drifted away from God. They're out in the wilderness, spiritually speaking. And now they're looking at the world you're looking at. And these are sobering times. Well, I mentioned the root cause, really, of it all, and it gets back to our sins. Yesterday, the Supreme Court, they came out with that ruling 6-3, actually. They took the Civil Rights Act from 1964, which says that you can't discriminate based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And they took sex, which, of course, in 1964 was referring to men and women. You can't discriminate against women. Well, they took that statute yesterday, and a majority ruling, not a 6-3, Neil Gorsuch. He was the conservative selected to replace Antonin Scalia. And he wrote the opinion for the liberals. And basically said this now means that you can't discriminate against someone based on their sexual orientation. So they just redefined the term sex so that now transgenders, homosexuals, they have a case. If they're working for a church or an organization that maybe is headed up by a believer, a Christian, and might not want a transgender working at his place, at his business, well, that company now could be penalized. It could be taken down in court based upon this. One commentator tweeted out that this is a brute force attack on our constitutional system. Here's the Supreme Court basically saying, you know what, we're not going to wait for Congress to pass a law or to pass. And Congress is not that far behind. This law would probably have come into place through the way that it should, by a vote. It's Congress that's to legislate, to make the law. The Supreme Court is just to uphold the law. But here they are. They're now legislators. Sam Alito in the dissent, he said the court attempts to pass off its decision as the inevitable product of the textualist school of statutory interpretation championed by our late colleague Justice Scalia. But no one should be fooled. The court's opinion is like a pirate ship. It sails under a textualist flag. But what it actually represents is a theory of statutory interpretation that Justice Scalia excoriated. The theory that courts should update old statutes so that they better reflect the current values of society. They just went back to 1964 and they changed the definition. They changed the definition. That's what we do now, as I covered last week on the program. Someone doesn't like the way Webster's defines racist? Well, we'll just send in your thoughts, and Webster's, of course, they'll cave into pressure. Of course, they'll add another definition to include systemic racism, institutionalized racism. Here come the Supremes. Sex doesn't just mean men and women. Now it includes transgenders. And if you just know a little bit of the history, well, this is a little bit of a longer clip, but I'll go ahead and play it because it's Andrew Napolitano at Fox giving you not only the update on what happened yesterday, but he provides some historical context, which is helpful here. Clip 5.
Basically, this is 172 pages over the meaning of the word sex. Did the word sex, S-E-X, the simple word sex, mean in 1964 what it means today? Or is the court just to interpret the statute in accordance with the plain meaning of the word as it is understood by the public? So look, in 1964, no one in the Congress thought that this applied to the LGBTQ community. The community was not organized. It wasn't called that then. Nobody thought it applied to gay and lesbians. We know that because Congress in 1964, when it was debating the Civil Rights Act of 1964, attempted to add protection for gays and lesbians, and it defeated that. Does that mean that Congress didn't want the protection in there? Or does it mean that the people that wanted to add it in there wanted to add it as a poison pill so that the entire statute would be defeated in 1964? Justice Gorsuch says none of that history matters. What matters is the word that Congress used, and it used the word sex. And when a human being is discriminated against on the basis of sexual orientation or sexual attraction or sexual behavior, that is discrimination based on sex, and therefore it is prohibited. This is what we call a landmark decision.
Judge Napolitano yesterday on Fox saying basically that Gorsuch, none of the history from the 1960s matters. None of the history matters. All that matters is that, hey, they use the word sex and we can kind of redefine it. We can redefine it and change the law. That's your Supreme Court in 2020. Sodom and Gomorrah is what Jesus prophesied. For the last days, we'd be just like the days of Noah before the flood, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. The New York Times pointed out, I think it's somewhere in my notes, if I can find it quickly. It says the Supreme Court is generally not very far out of step with popular opinion. Now, my father's made the point about how that the Supreme Court is going to be providing the Trump administration with some measure of protection. The president has appointed two of those justices. But on this point of the culture, in the culture wars, the New York Times in this case is right. They're generally not very far out of step with popular opinion. With respect to the culture, just go along with the majority. Go along with the mob. And never mind history. Just erase it. None of that history matters. Hey, the statute used the word sex, so we can just redefine it to include homosexuals, to include transgenders, to include the whole community, LGBTQ. A landmark ruling, says Napolitano. History erased, yet another example. There's a war against history, and it's intense, in case you haven't noticed. These kids yesterday, I think it was yesterday, they pulled down this statue at this school in Portland, Jefferson High School, named after Thomas Jefferson, has a statue of Thomas Jefferson out front, and the mob pulled it down. The mob destroyed it. The mob was cheering. President Trump was right. He was right. Going back to that contentious press conference, I played the clip a week or two ago. Well, the reporter said, it's just about some of these Confederate individuals, these personalities that had slaves. Those are the ones that we want to take down. Well, but now what about Thomas Jefferson, he said? He's a founding father. Does he go, do we remove the Jefferson Memorial in Washington? What about this school? Do they have to change their name? The mob pulls it down. This is from the Federalist. Talking about the mob and this push to pull down statues in the United States, in Britain. With respect to the U.S., it says their target is not the Confederacy. It's the United States. You see, you just saw the image, the clip from Chaz. You're saying if you go in there as a rabid left-wing radical, yeah, it's a safe environment, relatively speaking. But don't go in there with a United States flag. This is an attack on the United States. They mean to destroy symbols of American history writ large. Because to them, all of American history is racist and genocidal. Their goal is not to cleanse a nation. They love of monuments to Confederate traitors who tried to secede. But to cleanse their consciences of ever having loved such an evil and irredeemably racist country in the first place. That's what's happening. And anyone with eyes to see can see it. You can see it if you just go to the mission statement of these organizations like Black Lives Matter. Imagine a movement based on the premise that all cops are bad. They're evil. They're racist. Even though, as I've said, so much of our police force in these major cities, they're minorities. Blacks and Hispanics that are looking after these communities. The Federalist says this is why you see mobs defacing statues and of abolitionists like Matthias Baldwin. That you may have heard this the other day. This statue of someone that wasn't a slave owner, he fought to abolish slavery. And looking at the founders, by the way, what about the ones that just detested the thought of slavery, like John Adams? In any event, it's not one side or the other that they're trying to get rid of. It's not the Confederates that they're trying to erase. The target is the United States. It says that's why you see mobs defacing statues of abolitionists like Matthias Baldwin and Union war heroes like Admiral David Farragut and General George Thomas. That's why the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier of the American Revolution in Philadelphia was vandalized this past weekend with words committed genocide. Genocide. That's why statues of Christopher Columbus were torn down or beheaded in three cities last week. Three different cities torn down. Columbus torn down. The war against America's history. And who would have ever thought that it would take someone like Donald Trump to remind us of our history? The left likes to pile it on him. Oh, he doesn't like reading. He doesn't read books. And here he is giving some, in the case of West Point over the weekend, he's giving exceptional speeches that remind us of our history. I understand he has a lot of help with speechwriters and such, but still, you look at his speech from Normandy last year at that anniversary, a powerful message. This is what the radical left, the Marxist revolutionaries, this is what the anarchists want to erase. This is what they want to remove. This is what they want to delete. One of our listeners told me about this speech. I didn't have time to look into it. I just saw a few commentators and what they had to say about the speech. But this was on Saturday, President Trump's speech before the West Point graduates, clip 10.
Right now, America needs a class of cadets that lives by your motto, with vision, we lead. We need you to carry on the spirit of the great General Ulysses S. Grant. Soon after assuming overall command, following 3 years of Union setbacks, General Grant encountered someone heading north to Washington during the Battle of the Wilderness. If you see the president, Grant said, tell him from me that whatever happens, there will never be no turning back. We need you to be as visionary as Patton, who as a young man in 1917 became the first soldier assigned to the Army Tank Corps. 1 month into the job, he saw the future writing. If resistance is broken and the line is pierced, the tank must and will assume the role of pursuit cavalry and ride the enemy to death. Under Patton's leadership, that's exactly what they did.
This used to be history that united Americans. This used to be history that was celebrated in the classroom. Ulysses S. Grant, I didn't have time to go and remember or remind myself of the details, but I remember leading up to the surrender of the South at Appomattox, just the great lengths that Grant went to not humiliate Lee, to not humiliate the South, because it was time for healing. It was time to bring the nation together. Where do you see a push for this in the United States of today? How are you going to put it back together? How are we going to fix this? This is the president of the United States as almost a lone voice, reminding us of history, the history of our fight for freedom, our fight for liberty. He went on to say, clip 11.
We need you to be as bold and determined as the immortal General Douglas MacArthur, who knew that the American soldier never ever quits. After leaving the Philippines for Australia at a low point of the Pacific War in 1942, MacArthur famously vowed, I shall return. For 2 years, he then took great strategic risks and placed himself often in personal danger. On October 20th, 1944, MacArthur stepped off a landing boat, strode through knee-high water, and proclaimed, people of the Philippines, I have returned. By the grace of Almighty God, our forces stand again on Philippine soil. He then called upon the island's brave people to rise up and join the fight. America's momentum was unstoppable.
Here's some of that history of MacArthur at our commencement here at Armstrong College a few weeks back. Here's the president in front of these cadets, in front of these West Point graduates, saying we need more MacArthurs, and do we ever. In fact, in our MacArthur booklet, we've had our last chance. My father makes the point that we no longer have Churchills and MacArthurs around. We no longer have leaders like this. And really, it's even worse. We don't even want them as part of the record. It's not the Confederates that the mob is targeting. It's America. It's the United States of America. And here's just one individual standing up to the mob, at least in this way, fighting for our history, reminding these graduates of their history. One final clip from his West Point speech, clip 12.
These great leaders were not afraid of what others might say about them. They didn't care. They knew their duty was to protect our country. They knew the Army exists to preserve the Republic and the strong foundations upon which it stands. Family, God, country, liberty, and justice. They were true, tough American patriots. That is what our country needs, especially in these times. And that is what you are.
President Trump on Saturday at West Point. Is this a message that's received by the radical left? Family, God, country, liberty, justice? Well, look at the Black Lives Matter mission statement. Their goal is to destroy the family, to remove God, to eliminate patriotism, and to replace it with a sort of collectivist, communist, communal state where everyone's dependent on the government, and the government has power, tremendous power, to impose its will. President Trump's reminding us of our foundation, preserving the republic and the strong foundations. Who would have ever thought it would be someone like Donald Trump to stir up some of this inspirational history, our own history? And yet it makes sense. If there's a Jeroboam on the scene and we're in the midst of a temporary resurgence, there would certainly have to be a higher regard for our own history. Make America great again. That implies that you understand a little bit about your history. Look, let's do it again. How important is it for us to be grounded in true history? I've been meaning to get to this email for some time now, because we had those programs a few weeks ago. There was the one on deleting history from the Dunkirk miracle. That was while we were over in the UK. But one of our listeners responding to those shows, he's from Canada. He says, I've thought about writing a few times to thank you and the team and just have let it pass, but it's nice to get feedback. And this week, the emphasis on history and comments from some listeners really sparked some memories. I've come to realize that growing up in the Commonwealth, when education and schooling was more structured, has been a great benefit for me and my family. It says, during primary school years and early high school, we would stand in our forms, the kindergartners at the front, the senior class at the back, be addressed by the headmaster, who was later called the principal, sing God Save the Queen, later to be replaced by Advance Australia Fair. It says teachers walking behind the older boys, giving them a nudge when they started to fool around or lose attention. This is how education used to be in Ephraim. These same teachers were very dedicated. We huddled around a transistor radio brought in by a teacher to listen to the commentary coming in from the JFK shooting. The same teacher in 1965 brought in a TV so we could watch Winston Churchill's funeral. And a few years later, we watched Apollo 11 land on the moon. I have vivid memories of the room being packed by our teachers and classes, as well as leaning in the windows as we were on the ground floor. It says, in primary school, our social studies class would start with all the red places on the map, the Commonwealth. We learned about these places, and I have now had the honor to visit the provinces and the culture and the history. He says, finally, after high school, I didn't really think much about these experiences, but now, a few decades later, I've had the opportunity and blessing to serve God's work in several places, and it has amazed me how so many my age who grew up in Commonwealth countries, the remnants of an empire, have experienced similar things. I've spoken with members in Sri Lanka, and well, he lists off all these areas. I've come to understand that the education structure was based on educating the empire We just didn't learn about our own country. We learned about the Commonwealth, the empire, and it was in a world context. What a view, a world view of history, of empire. This is what the mob wants to erase. It's not the Confederates, switching back to the U.S., it's not the Confederates that they want to remove. It's not the Confederates that are the target. It's America. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit feedback, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.